This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Thank you very much, Roger. And at 7 minutes after 5 o'clock on this Saturday morning, we'll spend, the next 57 minutes or so with you here on the Saturday morning show. Thank you for joining us every week. Max Armstrong and I continue to cover news of the most basic industry in this country, feeding people, agriculture. And without that, nothing else happens. So we have several different topics to talk about this morning. And we're coming to the end of June Dairy Month. So again, let me remind our listeners in Wisconsin, you still have a few more June Dairy Month breakfasts on the farm that will continue through the end of the month. And we're getting into county fair season. County fairs getting underway here in the Midwest. And again, you can generally get a list of county fairs, dates, and locations by going to the website for the Department of Agriculture in whatever state you live in. On their website, you'll find a county fair schedule. And the weather today is gorgeous, at least the start of the day. And here in Huntley, Illinois, it's looking very bright right now off to the east. Well, as I mentioned, talking to Matt earlier, we're going to talk about marketing agricultural products from the United States, including milk, to China. So we're going to check in with our man in Washington, Patrick Haggerty, to start the story report, but we'll do that right after we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. Well, for many, many years, we have depended on Patrick Haggerty to keep us posted on agricultural events in our nation's capital. And this past week, he did some work on the export picture for dairy products. So right now, let me share Patrick Haggerty's story on milk exports. Patrick?
After more than 2 years of negotiation, the U.S. Dairy Export Council reached an agreement that will allow more dairy exports to China.
Currently signed MOU with China actually now means we can export the full range of our dairy products, meeting the SPS requirements. It really set the glide path to overcome an obstacle that the two governments had.
The U.S. Dairy Export Council also works on market access and market protection all around the globe.
Well, with regards to NAFTA, America's dairy farmers should know that we do support modernization of a 23-year-old trade agreement. Our position with regards to Mexico market access is, you know, do no harm to the current access we already have. Don't take any steps backward. Go ahead and shore up the rules that of trade with regards to SPS agreement, the phytosanitary agreement, as well as make sure that we will protect our access for common food names or geographic indicators. We need to, on the Canadian side, we need to really go after their habitual abuse of policy tools for preventing dairy trade. We want to seek the immediate elimination of their Class 6 and 7 pricing scheme. This actually distorts bilateral trade as well as global trade in the area of milk powder. So we really need those issues addressed. With regards to TPP, you know, there were great strides made in the rule-making side of TPP. We want to make sure that in any bilateral negotiation going forward, that floor is maintained on those rules of SPS as well as the protection of common food names. Origin. So that is important to us, and we want to make sure there. Now, taking on bilateral trade, that's fine. If that's the path we're going on, we support it, but we need to really get started on those negotiations. And from a dairy perspective, you know, Japan would be our first preference. But it is important that we take action now and start those discussions.
In 2016, America sold $384 million worth of dairy product to China, making China our third largest dairy trading partner behind Mexico and Canada. This new agreement means that we'll be selling more dairy product to China in years 2017 and beyond. In Arlington, Virginia, overlooking the Washington, D.C. skyline, Patrick Haggerty.
It's 17 minutes after 5 o'clock. Temperature at O'Hare, 62, the beginning of a beautiful Saturday here in this part of the Midwest. And despite the fact that earlier in the spring we had more than enough rain, too much rain, as a matter of fact, in some of the Midwest crop areas, but yesterday Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue took issue to deal with drought. The Secretary yesterday authorized emergency grazing on Conservation Reserve Program lands in Montana, North Dakota, and South Dakota, all of these states experiencing severe or extreme drought conditions. And the Secretary said due to reduced availability of forage, ranchers in the hardest hit locations have already been culling their herds, and without alternative forage options like grazing the CRP lands, livestock producers are faced with the economically devastating potential of herd liquidation. Emergency grazing authorized to begin immediately and extends through September 30th. Unless conditions improve. Producers must work with the Natural Resources Conservation Service to develop a modified conservation plan that is site-specific. So anyway, that action taken yesterday by Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue, wasting little time in getting to help some of the ranchers who need forage out in the Dakotas and Montana. Well, Max Armstrong has been spending a day or two in his home state of Indiana visiting with people to see if he can find an answer to this question.
So how much would we miss the animal agriculture industry, Orion, if we didn't have it in the Midwest? Well, there are many communities that would be hurting for sure. And that's the basis of some research that was paid for by the Indiana Soybean Alliance. I talked about that the other day with one of the directors on the board of the Indiana Soybean Alliance, Angie Steinbarger. She's from Edinburgh in the southern part of Indiana.
The Indiana Soybean Alliance, as well as several other of the commodity groups, were able to sponsor an economic impact of animal agriculture study for their each region in Indiana. And it is amazing the results that were that resulted from that study. We have about $11.2 billion worth of animal agriculture in our state. That's about 21,000 farms that have animal agriculture. And what's amazing to me is how much money that impacts for our communities.
I noticed it's a fairly detailed report. I saw the PDF file. It looks like it's well over 20 pages. But can you give us a little more of the executive summary, I guess, if you will, in terms of what is talked about within the study? For example, the jobs created, I think, is one thing that is mentioned there.
Right. What it does do, this particular study shows not only the direct impact of animal agriculture, but it does show that ripple or multiplier effect. And one thing that surprised me in that particular report is that for every job in animal agriculture, say for poultry and egg production, there are additional 6 people employed as a result of having that one worker in production of eggs. And that also translates into a different additional dollars. So for each dollar of sale from eggs generates 88 cents of additional income for our state through other entities. Like, say, for an instance, if you produce pork, you buy feed. That's the number one consumer of our soybeans in Indiana. And as a result of that, those people that work in the poultry and the pork industry will then spend those dollars out in the community. So it's a win-win for not only agriculture in general, but also for our economy as a whole in the state.
A pork producer friend of mine has made the point many times that there is that remarkable ripple effect. They'll say all the way from the local Casey's to when the plate is passed at church to the property taxes that support the schools, if you were to take out the animal agriculture component, many of these communities would be in dire straits.
I agree with that, Max. I actually live in a very small community. Our school system doesn't really have a town. And if you take out animal agriculture and agriculture in general, there just wouldn't be anything to support the local school.
You made an interesting point, too, about how much of the soybean crop in Indiana is consumed within the state. I think I saw a report here recently, I guess it was from the Indiana Soybean Alliance, that 95% of all of the soybean meal that is produced in Indiana gets consumed in Indiana. That surprised me a little bit. I thought maybe there would be somewhat of a trade surplus, that much of that would be shipped out of Indiana. But I guess it really is important for the soybean grower to realize that right there within that state is the biggest market for the soybeans that are grown within the state.
I feel very fortunate. In the area where we live, there's a lot of poultry production, and there's a soybean processing plant very close to where I live that generates the meal for those particular birds, and that's very helpful, as well as Bunge's not too far away, and there's several hog operations close to us where they'll be using that soybean meal as well.
It should be noted there's been significant opposition at times to new operations going in and the expansion of existing ones. And that is always a major concern for you folks, who, not just in animal agriculture, but those of you who rely upon those consuming units of hogs and cattle and chickens.
That is true. I'm sure that, you know, there is opposition at times, but I think this study really shows the impact of that animal agriculture. It helps the public in general in their economy to have animal agriculture close to us. And, you know, it's not only helping farmers because it's using the products that we produce, but it also generates dollars for those communities, so additional people have jobs, incomes, and are able to stay in that community.
Angie, is the idea here to not only be able to share this with consumers, but with state legislators, with county commissioners, county boards, so that they can understand, too, when various things of importance to animal agriculture and the grain producers who supply them come before those various governmental bodies?
That is true, and I think that is a very important part of the study, as well as, you know, I'm a farmer as well, and I look at this report as what it could do for me personally if I would expand our animal agriculture operation.
Angie Steinbarger, she lives on a farm in Indiana, southern Indiana. She's one of the members of the board of the Indiana Soybean Alliance. She's from Edinburgh. There are quite a few folks on that board from the northern part of the state that we know, too. Kendall Culp and Dave Rodabaugh, for example, both from down in that Rensselaer area. Just a reminder, Orion, of how much it means in many of our small towns and cities across this part of the country to have those birds and hogs and cattle being produced right there.
You're absolutely right, Max, because I really don't think many people off the farm or ranch realize how many jobs are created because farmers and ranchers are doing what they do. The technology, the equipment, the labor for exporting, a lot of people have jobs because of agriculture. Coming up on 26 minutes after 5 o'clock, and out of Kansas City, Kansas yesterday, news that a jury ordered Syngenta to pay $217.7 million to more than 7,000 Kansas farmers because of its decision to commercialize a genetically modified strain of corn before China approved it for import. The verdict, announced by lawyers for the farmers who blamed the Swiss company for causing catastrophic damage to them after Chinese officials began refusing U.S. corn shipments in 2013. Now, this case was the first to go to trial. Thousands of other corn producers and traders also are seeking damages over that action by Syngenta and China's refusal. Lawyers for the corn producers said in a statement that the verdict was only the beginning. They have claimed that damages for farmers nationally totaled $5.7 billion. Now, no surprise, Syngenta said it will appeal the verdict, which included only compensatory damages and no punitive damages. In a statement, Syngenta said, "We are disappointed with today's verdict because it will only serve to deny American farmers access to future technologies even when they are fully approved in the United States." In 2010, you may recall, Syngenta began selling in the United States a strain of insect-resistant, genetically modified corn called AgriSure Viptera. It started selling a second strain called AgriSure Duracade in 2013. Well, in the lawsuit, the Kansas corn farmers accused Syngenta of negligently commercializing the corn seeds before obtaining export approval in China, which is a major importer. And so in 2013, Chinese officials detected Viptera in the corn shipments from the U.S., and China began rejecting shipments containing millions of metric tons of U.S. corn because they contained the strain. Nearly 90% of corn in the United States is now genetically engineered, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The loss of the Chinese market caused U.S. corn prices to plummet, leading to over $5 billion in losses for corn producers, according to attorneys for the farmers filing the suit. So that's going to be an interesting one to watch, but if you're a Kansas farmer involved in that suit and are waiting to get the $217 million, I wouldn't go out and spend it yet, because I'm sure the process of going through the appeals courts will take quite a while. So this one we'll watch, and we'll see how it makes it through the appeals court, and then how many more lawsuits are going to be filed around the country because of that move by Syngenta. We're coming up on 5:30 news time here on WGN Radio Chicago. We'll be taking a look at the market activity this past week with Paul Georgie of Allendale. And of course, Friday we got the cattle on feed report, mildly bearish, they're saying, and we'll talk a little more this morning about the reports coming up on Friday, June 30th. Well, thank you very much, Roger, and you have a great weekend, and enjoy this beautiful weather that we're starting out with here in the Chicagoland area and through much of the Midwest as well. The county fair activity is getting underway this week. As a matter of fact, not too far from where I grew up in Wisconsin, Elroy, Wisconsin, has its fair. And I think the fair in Morris, Illinois, gets underway the end of this week. So you may want to make plans to get out and enjoy a county fair. County fairs, I think, are one of the great bits of Americana, and as are state fairs, and so I hope you'll support them with your attendance and your participation. It's the place for 4-H and FFA members to show off their skills in livestock as well as many other projects. So we hope that we'll run into many of you at some of the county fairs we'll be attending this year. Right now, we say welcome to Samuelson Says, sponsored by Wink Products Company. makers of quality specialty cleaning equipment since 1947. I'm Orion Samuelson. This week, looking for your help in getting answers to some of my questions. The folks at Wink Products Company want to help make your life easier with a family of professional strength cleaning products. Wink Rust Stain Remover is the number one liquid rust stain remover in the country. This professional strength formula dissolves the ugly rust stains on white sinks and toilet bowls. The little brown bottle has been around for 70 years, and it's still number one. Check us out at wink.com. That's WHINK.com. There are questions that I need your help because I can't come up with the answers. But let me begin by saying whatever I say for the next 2.5 minutes has no bearing on politics, Republican or Democrat. You will not learn any clue as to how I voted in the last election, but these are some things that I wonder. And, of course, I wonder about the millions of dollars and the thousands of man-hours we're spending on conducting investigations in Congress, finding out if the Russians indeed did hack into our election system. If they did, I'm not clear what difference it would make. Would it change the outcome of the election? I don't think so. But they certainly are spending a lot of our tax dollars to find out, and while they do, they are ignoring some of the issues they really need to work on. Another question. Why is it that the members of Congress who make the laws don't involve themselves in Social Security? Members of Congress have their own retirement program that's quite a bit better than Social Security. And they write the rules on health care. But they're not part of the health care that you and I are because they have their own congressional health care service. And I wonder why that is and why it should be. And then, of course, everything that happens is contentious. The way that Mr. Trump gets criticized makes it sound to me like those who do it want to see him fail. If there's one thing I don't want to see, I don't want to see another president leaving office early. Why is it that we don't support a president and say, good luck, because we depend on you? Oh, for the days of Ronald Reagan, president, and Tip O'Neill, House Speaker, getting together at the end of the day over a glass of scotch and hammering out many of the differences that Republicans and Democrats had. We need to get back to that civility. My thoughts on Samuelson Says. A presentation of Tribune Radio Networks at 21 minutes before 6 o'clock. Standing by, Paul Giorgi of Allendale to talk about market activity and particularly some of the reports that are due out this week. So stand by. We'll get to that when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. Paul Giorgi of Allendale, based in McHenry, Illinois, joins us today for our discussion of markets. And this is really my first weekend back after a long absence. But that absence, watching the markets, man, they've been all over the place.
Well, some of them have. Some of them have been all over the place. Livestock markets certainly have. Grain markets have moved mostly in the downward direction in the last few weeks here anyway. But we've certainly still been in a trading range in corn. I mean, you stick their head out above the trading range for a day or two or a week, and then we fall right back into the trading range. So the biggest problem that I see, Orion, is that we still have got a large supply of corn, old crop stocks that we have to move, and that's what's dragging on the market right now. We've got a lot of grain that has to be priced based on the some of the contracts that farmers have made, the basis contracts, deferred pricing contracts that come due right here at the end of June. they've got to get them priced, and that's putting extra pressure on the market as we see it here in the last few days.
Fair amount of discussion about a month ago that there were a lot of shorts in the grain market. Have they changed that position?
There was a lot of shorts. Funds had 200,000 shorts at one point in time, and as of last week here, they have come to they've basically flat the corn market. So they have got out of those shorts pretty much flat. Funds actually have been buyers in soybeans and in wheat as well. So they've reduced their short positions, but it hasn't done much to our upside momentum here. It's given us a little bit of boost, but still staying in the trading range.
Yeah,
weather is the big factor that we've got to deal with.
Right, but with the replanting being done, pollination time is going to probably run more than 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah, the last time you and I talked about that, we were worried about a narrow time frame. Today, we got to worry about a long time. I mean, it could be 6 weeks pollination. I know we've got some corn in southern Illinois and the Midwest here pollinating and tasseling already. And we've got corn in northern Illinois that it's going to be several weeks, a month or so before it tassels, as it's only a couple inches out of the ground because of the replanting.
And then a quick question on spring wheat. North Dakota and the dryness that they've had out there, has that gone away?
Well, it hasn't gone away. It's hard to fix. They've got such a short growing season up there, and if they don't get the crop in out of the ground and going good early in the season, it's hard to catch up. So rains right now are not going to do us much good in the North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, Minnesota area, because we need to it'll help some. It'll help the crops that did get off to a start, but it's not going to bring it back. On a weekly basis, we see the good to excellent conditions continue to slide. As a producer told me up there, it doesn't matter what the beauty contest looks like. You got to have something for that to happen, and the wheat just didn't grow because there was no moisture when they planted it.
So let's talk about June 30th, next Friday. What's going to happen that will impact the market?
Well, we got a big USDA acreage report, planted acreage. And that's planted acreage assumed by the government as of June 1. So we're thinking that the farmers and the survey that the USDA did on June 1, it's likely not going to give us much change in corn planted acres. It actually could increase some of the soybean planted acres. However, we think the big change in acreage won't come until October, when the USDA finally gives us the planted, the prevent planted numbers. So it's probably not going to be a big deal, but dealing with the USDA, you never know when you're going to have a surprise coming from them. But we're kind of looking for probably steady acres on corn, maybe a little higher acres on soybeans.
And then we get the quarterly pig crop report.
Quarterly pig crop report is another thing that pork producers probably are going to show an increase in pork production. Looking at the numbers that we have right now, and we're dealing with, it looks like we're going to be 4% higher than by the marketing hogs later on this year. It could be as much as 4% higher than a year ago. And you add some weight to that, we're going to have plenty of pork supplies. So right now in the month of June and July, profitability is good for hog producers. But we think they need to use the opportunities in the market right now, using options or futures to price some of their risk or hedge their risk going into the fall.
And looking at the dress pork trade this week, pretty good advances there.
Very good advances. And, you know, where is that coming from? Coming from a little tighter supply of hogs that we didn't expect, the trade didn't expect. The other area that it's coming from is demand for the 4th of July holiday, and usually pork outpaces beef during this period of time, and it's doing again this year. We're also seeing probably some fill-in buying by retailers featuring pork because of the higher price of beef at the retail counter. So Will that continue? Probably not very long. As we get into the dog days of summer here in the next, as we turn this calendar into July, it looks like we're going to have plenty of meat around both beef and pork.
So let's talk about beef for a moment. It's been on a roller coaster ride. It gets going one direction and it keeps going, and then suddenly it turns around and goes the other direction. What's ahead for cattle producers?
Well, I think it's not a real bright picture. I think there will be opportunities ahead of us. One of the big problems that we have is that we have the supply of cattle that are ready to go to market are increasing. Weights are increasing. Feedlots are going to have to get these cattle marketed and keep them marketed on a very fresh pace. So I think when you look at the charts and the technical aspect of the market, it projects that we could go down to the 108 to 106 area for fed cattle as we get into August, which historically August, October is a very weak period anyway. So I think we're trending lower here for a few months, and then probably a sideways, more choppy market after that.
And, of course, they can't change production that quickly in the cattle market. Hogs, short period, but not in cattle.
Cattle, it takes a little longer. As we've seen a year ago, we had very low prices at the end of 2016, and then we had a rally going into the May-June period here this year. So it's a 6-8 month time frame of the way this thing moves. And the futures are always futures. They're ahead of the game, at least what they think they are at most of the time. So that's what we got to look at right now. But with cheap feed cost, the cattle producer still is making money today.
And then looking at the export market, do traders pay a lot of attention to what we're doing in the export world with beef and pork?
Well, I think they do at times. The easy thing is to look at the supply and look at how much production we have on a weekly basis in livestock. But you got to look at why our price is high. And then when you look at that, you say exports are the main reason that this is continuing, because we can only eat so much meat in the U.S. Yeah. We've got to export it. And I think the arrangements that we've made with China on beef, certainly a positive. It probably doesn't change the total exports that much, but the attitude has changed, and that's extremely important.
Going back to June 30th, next Friday, supply-demand report comes into play on that one, doesn't it, on the grain market?
Well, it's the stocks in all positions report.
Stocks in all positions.
Stocks in all positions report come out, and that's going to be a watch very closely. How much corn, how much soybeans do we have as of June 1? The other big thing is how much is stored on the farm, I think, is a critical number that's got to be watched. In March, we had a lot more corn on the farm than we had in the commercial elevators. If the farmer's still holding this grain, it just doesn't look like we're going to have much of a rally until that, as we said, have said in years while we've been in this business, it's got to be in strong hands. And usually the grain in farmers' hands is not considered the strong hands. So it's got to be in commercial hands.
So does Allendale have any upcoming reports that are going to be available to your customers?
Well, we've actually got our webinar and our summer conference that's coming up here in the end of July that we'd like as many people to get involved with us on. They certainly can do that online. Mm-hmm. We sell that, and they can get all the details right at allendale-inc.com. And we've also got a monthly webinar that we'd love to have them join us on. That is free. So
okay.
There's a lot of things going on. We try to keep people informed the best we can.
So again, Allendale-Inc,
I-N-C.
Inc, I-N-C.com.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us this week. Paul Giorgi, who is with Allendale, I guess he owns it or leads it or something like that, based in McHenry, Illinois.
5.5 minutes before 6 o'clock, and of course, since President Trump announced a change in relations with Cuba, the question for agricultural producers and consumers has been, what will all of this mean? Well, to try to get an answer or two, we turn to the Senior Director for Congressional Relations with the American Farm Bureau. Senior Director, Congressional Relations, joins us. And it's been an interesting time in trade relations, hasn't it, David?
Well, there's certainly been a lot going on, and President Trump has been making lots of news, both at the beginning of his administration with TPP and now with his announcements about Cuba.
And let's talk about Cuba, because we have conducted agricultural trade with Cuba since trade parameters were changed a little bit a couple of years ago. How much trade have we done with Cuba?
You know, since the passage of legislation in Congress in the year 2000 allowing for U.S. food trade to Cuba, it's varied. We got up to almost $700 million a year in 2008, and right now we're selling about $220 million a year in food and ag products to Cuba.
And which of our ag products is in greatest demand in Cuba?
Well, it's varied across several commodities. Poultry is one of the top commodities, over $100 million worth of poultry products, so almost half. The rest is distributed among corn, soybeans, soybean meal, and a few other products. But certainly poultry is the number one product that is demanded from the U.S. by Cuba.
Dave, what does the recent direction from the Trump administration have on current ag trade or possible ag trade between the United States and Cuba?
Well, the policies that the president announced last week were mostly going towards travel and tourism, nothing directly on agriculture that we can see. Now, there's a potential that the president's comments, and we'll see how the regulations from the Treasury Department are written, that deals with the ports. Certainly, a lot of these things are at the military. Military has some certainly running of some of the ports. So would they have an impact on U.S. Products being imported through Cuban ports? We don't know that, but we'll watch the regulations closely. But there's nothing really that we could see that directly should have any impact on U.S. ag sales to Cuba.
And what might be the potential ultimately between the United States and Cuba when it comes to ag trade?
Well, I think there's a lot of potential for growth in two senses. One, we were really looking at the growth in tourism, especially U.S. Tourism, to have a demand for a larger variety of U.S. food products, especially if U.S. hotels were there, feeding American vacationers. We think there'd be a growing demand there. So if that's at least leveled off or somehow doesn't grow, that'll change the demand there.
Dave Salmonson with AFBF Talking Trade in Cuba with us today. Thank you, Dave.
Very much. Happy to be here.
And happy to have you here, David, and keep on working the agricultural aisles in Congress for a lot of trade issues still on the table. We didn't have time to get into the cattle on feed report with Paul Giorgi when we were talking to him a few minutes ago, but here are the numbers that came out yesterday afternoon. Cattle and calves on feed for the slaughter market came in at 11,100,000 head on June 1st. That inventory 3% above June 1st a year ago. Placement of cattle in feedlots during May totaled 2,120,000, 12% above a year ago. And marketings of fed cattle during May totaled 1,950,000 head. That's up 9% from a year ago. Now, even though the numbers, a couple of them are higher than expected, perhaps, but not by much, the reaction initially is that big marketings are neutral to friendly to the front months in the cattle market, but placements and on-feed numbers neutral to negative to back months. So we'll wait till Monday to see how they react. We did end the week with live cattle futures closing higher ahead of the report yesterday afternoon. And cash cattle for the week sold from $118 to $123 per hundredweight in the plains. That's down from $127 to $134 a week earlier. So anyway, we'll keep our eye on agriculture and agribusiness as we always do. But for now, we're out of time here on this Saturday morning. Want to thank Bob Ferguson for making sure all the switches are thrown so that I can talk to you from our studios in Huntley. And we'll be back with you again next Saturday. That'll be the first day of July. We hope you'll join us then. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.